This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodl Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Now, we often have a lot of interviews about very large-scale things on the Jodcast, galaxies and cosmology and so on. But our colloquium this week was Dr. Pierre Maxted of Keele University, who was telling us about searching for extrasolar planets, planets outside our solar system. So I thought I'd just first ask you, how on earth do you find a planet that's around another star?
So the signal that we're looking for is called a transit. So if you have a planet like Jupiter in our own solar system, that goes around the Sun every few years. But there are a class of planets that were discovered in 1995 called hot Jupiters. Now they go around their stars every few days. And they'd go around every few days because they've got less fast travel, because they're really close to the star. These things orbit around their stars 10 times closer than the Earth does around the Sun. So it's within the orbit of Mercury.
So why do you refer to them as hot Jupiters?
Because they're so close to their stars, one side of them is hot. They get up to around 2,000 degrees Kelvin, which is hot enough to melt rocks. So any clouds in the atmospheres of these objects are made out of vaporized rocks. So when they're that close to the star, there's a fairly good chance, when viewed from the Earth, that during the orbit, this planet will go between the Earth and the star. So it will block the light of the star. So that will give you a dip in the brightness, because you're blocking some of the light from the star. It'll give you a dip in the brightness of about 1%. So if you monitor thousands and thousands of stars, similar to the Sun, and you monitor them for long enough, some of them will produce this little dip that lasts a few hours. It's about 1% deep, and it keeps recurring. This is why we know it's not due to a cloud or a bird flying in front of the star in the Earth's atmosphere or what have you. It's because it keeps happening on a well-defined period. It keeps happening, say, every 3.5 days or 2.5 days or whatever it is. So when you see that signal around a star like that, you've got a good candidate for saying there is a gas giant planet orbiting that star. And then you need more specialized observations using spectrographs to confirm that that's due to a planet and not due to something else.
So I might come on to the spectrograph bit in a minute, but the actual project you've been working on, I think we once had an interview about it before, but that was a little while ago. And I think that at that time there'd been about 9 planets found by that project. So could you tell us a bit about it and how it's getting along?
So the planet searching project is called WASP, Wide Angle Search for Planets. So we have 2 instruments, one in the Northern Hemisphere on the Canary Islands, and we have one in the Southern Hemisphere in South Africa, about 5 hours' drive away from Cape Town, 2 good astronomical sites. Each of those instruments has 8 cameras on it. So the camera lens is actually a normal camera lens, like the type of thing you'd see. Let's say if you look around the edge of a football pitch, you'll see journalists there with these huge camera lenses. Well, we have 8 of those camera lenses on each of the instruments, and they give us wide fields of view. The detectors are similar to the detector you'd find in a digital camera, but they're very, very high quality, so they're much more expensive. But they're much more sensitive, and they give us much better quality of data. So we take these good quality camera lenses, good quality CCD lenses, we make an array of 8 of them on each instrument, and we use them to monitor a large area of the sky. With one exposure, with one snapshot, we get an image that's about 15 by 30 degrees on the sky. And so we monitor, say, 10 or 12 patches of sky every night. We'll go back to them every 5 or 10 minutes and take an image. Every camera will have an image of about 8 by 8 degrees, and there'll be, say, 100,000 stars, and we'll measure the brightnesses of all those stars in all those images, and we might get 1,000 images a night. So overall, we're accumulating a vast quantity of data so that we can monitor thousands and thousands of stars. And that's enabled us to find, so far, in the region of 40 to 50 planets. There's 40 or so that we've announced, and there's about another 10 that we're in the process of checking all the numbers, working out exactly how big the planets are, and getting those written up for publication and announcement.
So with these 2 sites, one in the Northern Hemisphere and one in the Southern Hemisphere, you're sort of able to mine the whole sky for where these exoplanets are?
Almost the entire sky, yes. The Northern Hemisphere instrument doesn't quite go to the Northern Pole, so there's a little patch around the Northern Pole we can't observe. And For technical reasons to do with the system that we use, we can't observe through the Milky Way. We can observe there, but the data quality is very poor. But apart from that, it's an all-sky survey, more or less.
Okay. And are you using enormous telescopes to do this searching?
No. The telescopes that we use are, as I said, these camera lenses, and the aperture that we use is about 4 inches, about 10 centimetres. That turns out to be the optimum size for doing a survey of this type. All the successful surveys are very similar in their design, and they have this aperture size of about 10 centimetres. The trade-off that you make, if you have a smaller aperture, you get a bigger field of view, but you have fewer stars because you can only go to the really bright ones. If you get a bigger telescope, you can look at fainter stars, but you get a smaller area. And the compromise turns out to be 10 centimetres turns out to be pretty optimum in that you're looking at fairly bright stars, so bright enough to see in binoculars, something between about 10th and 12th magnitude. Mm-hmm. And there's enough of those that you can survey a large number of stars.
So is it something that an amateur person could do with a telescope? I mean, how much would it cost to kind of set up a project like that?
You could do it from your back garden. You'd have to be pretty wealthy. It is possible to detect these transits using off-the-shelf equipment. So if you had something like a 14-inch or 16-inch telescope and a good quality CCD, and you are patient enough to get the data quality that you need, it has to have a good tracking mount, you have to have good control over your focus, you need a pretty good sight. But it is possible to detect these transits using amateur equipment, and that's been shown, that's been done. It's been done by several amateurs. In terms of actually searching for planets, you'd be pretty lucky to find one because it's only 1 in 1,000 stars that have these transits. But there are about 100 stars that are known to transit, and so you can go and observe the transit of an exoplanet using amateur equipment, either your own, if you're lucky enough to own big telescopes, or if you're a member of an astronomical society, they may have the equipment that you could do this. And it's an interesting thing to do, because we discover them, we show that they're planets, and then we tend to move on and do other observations of that planet. But we don't monitor the transits. We don't go back and see if the transits keep happening at a regular time. And there's actually science to be got out of measuring the transit times. And so there's an ongoing project, often done by amateurs, to just monitor these transit times and see if they start doing something strange.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because you tend to just think that amateur astronomy is going to be stars and perhaps some nebulae and perhaps some galaxies, but actually looking at planets outside our solar system, I mean, no one had even done that, 20 years ago?
1995 was the discovery of the first extrasolar planet. Yes, prior to 1995, extrasolar planet science was thoroughly disreputable. It was not considered to be a serious part of astronomy. But now it's the biggest thing in astronomy, and everyone's getting involved, including the amateurs.
So it really opens up a whole new avenue of research. So what I'm wondering is, once you've found some planets with WASP, for example, how do you then find out something about what you've found?
There's various techniques. Probably the easiest ones to explain are the eclipse measurements. So we see the transits. That's how we detect them. You can do that in the optical regime. And that's caused by the star's light being blocked by the planet. Half an orbit later, the planet goes behind the star. And so you get an eclipse of the planet by the star. Now, the planet is much, much fainter than the star. So that's a small effect. But it is measurable, particularly at infrared wavelengths, because the surface of the planet is generally, as I mentioned, around about 2000 Kelvin. So it radiates most of its energy in the infrared. Measuring these small flux drops, flux changes due to the eclipse of the planet, is hard from the ground, but it has been done in the near infrared. But the most successful observations of eclipses have been done from space using the Spitzer infrared space telescope. That's been the workhorse for the study of these extrasolar planets, for eclipse measurements certainly. That gives you a measurement of exactly how hot that heated surface of the planet is. And if you make measurements at many wavelengths, with ground-based observations through the near-infrared into the far-infrared with Spitzer, you can then start to put constraints on what the composition of the atmosphere is. You can models through the observations and rule out some models and rule in other models and say the distribution of light coming off the day side of this planet is, for example, consistent with water being in the atmosphere as mm-hmm. steam. And there was one planet we recently studied called WASP-12, the 12th planet we announced, that had a rather peculiar pattern of flux measurements in the infrared. And it turned out that the reason for that was that oxygen was missing from the atmosphere, and that meant the atmosphere couldn't make water. What it could make was hydrogen plus carbon, and it made methane, so it had strong absorption at a certain wavelengths due to methane, and the absorption due to water was missing. So we could say that that planet is carbon-rich. Most planets are oxygen-rich. The Earth is oxygen-rich, for example. But so this was a discovery of a new class of planet, carbon-rich planets, which instead of having a silicate core, and sort of silicate rocks like you'd have on the Earth, would have carbide rocks and might, for example, have a core made out of pure carbon. Mm-hmm. So a diamond core, if you like.
So you're doing these spectral measurements and you're looking at the light coming from the star and from the planet at all these different wavelengths and then looking for these particular telltale wavelengths where certain chemicals or certain elements are mm-hmm. either emitting or absorbing light, and that's yes. that's your kind of spectral signature, this set of lines.
Yes.
And that's also, I think, sometimes another method for how extrasolar planets are actually discovered.
So when we get the signature that's due to what we think might be due to a planet, this dip of about 1% lasts a few hours, happens every few days. There's many things that can mimic that signal. Things like you can get pairs of stars that give a very similar signal. So what we then do is we give those candidates over to the experts in measuring the velocities of the stars. So this was how the first extrasolar planet was discovered by Michel Mayor and Didier Queloz. And in fact, we collaborate with Didier Queloz to do this follow-up of our candidates. If you look at the spectrum of a star like the Sun, if you split up the light with a really good quality spectrograph, you see thousands and thousands of lines in the spectrum, meaning that at particular, very well-defined wavelengths, there's a drop in the flux. And that gives you a sort of ruler of how fast the star is going away from you. If you can measure the positions of those thousands and thousands of lines, take the average result, you can very precisely measure how fast the star is moving towards you or away from you. For a single star, then, that will just be a constant number. It'll just be drifting through space with a constant radial velocity. If there's a planet going around it, the star will wobble backwards and forwards by about 50 meters per second or so. And that's the signal that Didier and Michel Mayor were looking for, was this periodic wobble in the velocity of the star.
So the star's doing a little orbit of its own.
The star's doing a little orbit of its own. If you imagine somebody who's throwing the hammer, so you've got some big bloke who weighs 100 kilos and he's swinging around a hammer that weighs 10 kilos. The hammer's going around really, really, really fast. But the man who's throwing the hammer does that nice little pirouette. He's moving around on a much smaller circle. And the size of the circle that he does compared to the size of the circle that the hammer does is the ratio of their masses. And that's how it works. The analogy then is you transform that to the man is the star that you can see, the hammer is the planet that you can't, but you can see the wobble of the star, you can see the wobble of the man. So there must be something out there making wobble.
And it's telling you about how massive the hammer is as well.
Exactly.
The planet.
If he's moving backwards and forwards a lot, it must be something very massive that's moving it around. So this is how we distinguish stars from planets as being the unseen thing that causes the transit. If the size of the wobble is too big, we can say that's too big to be a planet, that's something else, which may be interesting in its own right, but it's not a planet. We're looking for a wobble due to a planet, so the wobble's got to be the right size, and it's got to happen on the same orbital period as the transits. So if the transits happen every 3.2 days, the wobble's got to go backwards and forwards every 3.2 days.
Mm-hmm. So of all these planets that are found, do we know if they're typical? Are they something like Earth, or are we getting a selection of rather unusual planets?
The hot Jupiters weren't expected, so they're unusual in that sense. But it's difficult to know whether they're typical for planetary systems in general. We know amongst the stars that have got planets going around them, which are gas giants, we know that the hot Jupiters are relatively common compared to the normal Jupiters or cold Jupiters. What we know much less about at the moment are the less massive systems. We're starting to get some information on those from people doing velocity surveys, but the thing that's really coming through now and telling us a lot about those is the Kepler satellite, because that's a space-based observatory and they don't have to deal with the variations in the atmosphere and they can observe continuously. They're able to see much, much smaller transits, and so we're getting a flood of information now from the Kepler satellite about the frequency or how often stars have rocky planets going around them. And it turns out there's many more rocky planets out there than there are gas giant planets. So the hot Jupiters that we find are really the tip of the iceberg, and the rocky planets, the things which are sort of several Earth masses, several Earth radii, the sort of super-Earths, they're much more common.
That's interesting, because I think something that almost every astronomer gets asked quite often is whether they think there's life out there in the universe. And usually I've said, gosh, I just don't know what most of the numbers are involved. I don't really have a good handle on how many planets there might be on which life could develop. But it seems as though these kind of missions are finally starting to give us a handle and perhaps quite an optimistic estimate for how many planets there might be out there.
There are several factors you want to take into account if you want to make an educated guess at whether there's life in the galaxy, apart from what we know of on the Earth. One of those factors is how many stars have got planets around them, because it's reasonable to assume that life would be on a planet. That is, as you say, optimistic. There appear to be plenty of planets out there. It was hard to find them, but once we've discovered how to look for them, there's plenty of them out there. So that all helps. The things that we still don't know are things like how many of those planets are at just the right distance from the star to have liquid water on them. We know of a few of those planets, but we don't have a good handle on the numbers for how common they are. And the really hard question to answer, which is possibly unanswerable, is, given the right conditions for life, how often does life occur? Much harder question to answer. You can get some idea of an answer to that by looking in the solar system at all the places where life could feasibly exist. So obviously on the Earth, we know that, but in places like Mars and under the ice of Saturnian moons and possibly on places like Titan, there's a possibility that life could be there. So this is why NASA really want to go and look at those places and see if life occurs whenever it can, whenever the conditions are right, do you get life. Even if there's one other instance of life occurring in the solar system independently of the Earth, that would give you optimism for saying if the conditions are right, then life will arise.
And just going back to the planets that WASP has found, I know they're not really candidate planets for having life on them, but you mentioned during the talk that they may not each individually be around for very long.
That's true. They're all doomed, in fact. All the hot Jupiter planets, all the planets that are gas giants orbiting stars like the Sun with periods of a few days, they're all doomed to fall into the star eventually. The tidal interactions between the star and the planet gradually dragging the planet in. So we know that they are going to fall onto their stars eventually. What we don't know so well is how long that process takes. We know that it can't be really fast, because otherwise we wouldn't see them at all. They all have disappeared already. But we don't actually know how long it takes, because the processes involved are complicated, to do with turbulence in the atmosphere of the star. So that's a hard physics problem to solve. But this is, for example, one of the reasons why you might want to do measurements of the transit times of some of these planets. In some cases, it may be possible to actually see the orbit decaying over the next 20 to 30 years. One star in particular, WASP-18, that we found, the planet is quite massive, and so it interacts quite strongly with the star. It orbits around its star in less than a day, so we may be able to see that planet gradually spiraling in to the star, because we should see the period of the star getting slightly shorter with time.
And are these planets usually tidally locked, so that they're only ever showing one face of themselves to the star in the same way as the Moon does with the Earth?
that's what we assume, because the tides are so strong, much stronger than the Earth-Moon system. So they do have a permanent day side and a permanent night side.
Right. So then, as they transit in front of the planet, you're looking at their dark side or their cold side.
That's right. And you can actually use that fact that the planet is rotating once per orbit to measure the distribution, to actually map the temperature of the planet. And that's something that has been done with the Spitzer Space Telescope. It's something I'm working on at the moment for WASP 18, is actually to measure the amount of infrared light that comes from the system over a whole orbital cycle. And what we're finding with WASP 18 is you can see a big contrast between the day side and the night side. The infrared flux changes by quite a lot as you go over the cycle, meaning that the day side is much brighter than the night side. So it's a bit of a mystery as to what's stopping all the energy that's falling on the day side from being blown round to the back side of the planet by the winds in the atmosphere of the planet.
So we're sort of able to use that data to perhaps even refine or rewrite some models of the nature of planets.
Yes, absolutely. So people who've worked on climate models for planets like the Earth and have extended those to planets in the solar system are now having great fun taking their models of the climate of a planet and applying it to these extreme systems and seeing how the models do. So they want as much observational data as possible to test their models with. And this measurement you can make of how efficiently the heat moves from the day side to the night side, it's a key parameter for determining the overall structure of the climate of these planets. So it's very important to measure it if you want to understand how these climate models do when you apply them to these very extreme systems.
So perhaps the last thing, how far do you see the WASP project going? How many planets do you think you can collect?
I think the number most of the people in the project have in their head is that we'd really like to get to 100.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we can do that by continuing to observe, but also with the images that we've already got in hand, we can improve the way that we analyze those images. So we are currently working on a relatively simple way of measuring the brightness of each star in each image. There are more sophisticated techniques out there that need to be adapted to the rather extreme images that we have, the very wide field images that we have. But by applying these more sophisticated data analysis techniques, we should be able to pull out good quality data for more stars in the existing data. If we combine that with continuing to observe so we can find longer period planets, and by improving the hardware by doing things like putting filters into the system and perhaps using different lenses where we can look at even brighter stars. With these combinations of different tricks and different techniques and hard work, well, I think we'll get to 100. I'd certainly be very happy if we got to 100. That would be a reason for great celebration.
Well, that's fascinating. I bet there'll be a few people who will want to get their telescopes out and try and actually follow up some of those extrasolar planets that you found. Thank you very much.
Thank you.